Welcome to the Global Australian Podcast. I'm Johanna Pittman, CEO of Advance, the Global Australian Network. We're the non-profit organisation committed to strengthening Australia by nurturing a globally connected mindset at home and abroad. One of the ways we do this is by shining a spotlight on the impact of extraordinary global Australians. In this podcast series, we meet 25 game changers recognised in the 2023 Global Australian Awards. These remarkable individuals generously share their stories with us, giving us insight into their international career journey, its highlights and challenges, and what motivates them in their work. I hope you enjoy getting to know the inspiring game changers of 2023. In this episode, we meet Annette Young, a 2023 game changer in the social impact category. Annette Young is host and creator of the 51% broadcast on France 24. Based in Paris, Annette's focus on reshaping narratives and amplifying marginalised voices is driving important and impactful discussions around the role of women in today's society.
In simple terms, how do you describe what you do?
Oh, where do I start? I think what I do with the 51% is hopefully challenge people's very deep-seated cultural attitudes towards the role of women. And I think the show's tagline says it all. It's a program about women reshaping our world. And of course, the title being the 51% indicates sort of broadly where we stand demographically, that we are a sizable chunk of the population. But if you look at our role in various sectors of society, we do not have the level of representation that one would presume to have, given that we're on, you know, we're in the 21st century. In fact, we're at 23 years into the 21st century. So it's my job as the creator, the producer, and the presenter of this program to sort of say to the viewer, hey, look at this, look at what's happening in this front, what's going on, you know, in terms of this story, and more importantly, how we as women are truly making a difference.
Tell us about how you got to doing this program and doing this program for a French news organisation and that journey of how you got there, sort of both geographically but also career-wise.
Okay, so I started off in terms of my own career. I began my journalism career at the Melbourne Age as a cadet journalist many years ago when dinosaurs were roaming the earth, so we won't say exactly when, but a long time ago. Subsequent to that, I was at the Sydney Morning Herald. I also had a stint in Canberra, and then I ended up at SBS Television, where I was the day editor for SBS World News before joining Dateline, their flagship program, as a senior producer. And in the year 2000, I moved to Paris. My mother was French, so it's not entirely a random choice of location. I ended up working there for Agence France-Presse, and then I ended up going to the Middle East for 7 years as a freelancer. I was based in Jerusalem. And in 2007 began working for what was then a fledgling network, France 24, as their Jerusalem correspondent for France 24 English. After a number of years in 2010, I had enough of the Middle East, was happy to swap hummus for foie gras, as I said, and sort of relocated to Paris to become a presenter for their news channel. Just to give you a little bit of backstory about France 24, because I imagine there are a lot of people, particularly in Australia, who are not aware of the network. We reach somewhere in the order of 300 million homes. We broadcast now in French, English, Arabic, and Spanish. And it is a 24-hour global newscaster. So in 2013, a very good friend and colleague on the French channel, Virginie Hertz, came to me with this idea of pitching a show about women's rights. And I sort of looked at her and she said, would you be interested in presenting this in English? And I sort of said, yes, I would. But, you know, what I know about feminism, I probably know more about Palestinian factions, given my stint at the Middle East, than I do about the big issues, you know, involving feminism. And as a result, she said, go away, read up about it. And a week later, I came back to her and I said, definitely count me in. I would love to present this show. And I'm absolutely horrified as a journalist that these stories are not being covered in the way they should. And I mean, here we are. We're marking the show's 10th anniversary this year. Our first show went to air in December 2013. We are the only program of its type on a global newscaster. There is nothing like it. We have a fresh edition every week. Virginie has moved on into another managerial role. She's been replaced by my colleague, Laure Manon, but we all work together very closely. And also, most importantly, we now have versions in Arabic and Spanish too. So we are reaching across in four languages. And as you can imagine, in terms of stories, what we cover, the world is our oyster. So as a global newscaster, it isn't just about France, obviously. We are beamed across the globe. So we're able to sort of report on numerous issues in numerous parts of the globe.
Wow. And in, since doing 51% for the last 10 years, what have been some of the big challenges you've faced in putting a show like this together, and what have been some of the highlights?
Well, France 24, being a public broadcaster, doesn't have a lot of money, as you can imagine. So this show is pretty much me, myself, I, with the help of a technical crew, and obviously I work closely with my French colleagues as well. And I would say it has been the most rewarding part of my career professionally, because when I started doing this program, I was as ignorant as anyone. I mean, yes, I called myself a feminist, but the reality is, as I began to peel back the layers of key issues, such as, for instance, the gender pay gap, which we now all talk about very openly. If you go back 10 years, that's something that was not discussed as much as it is, about parental leave, about sharing the mental load that most mothers, working mothers, carry, about menopause, about period poverty, about political representation, about boosting the level of representation in the corporate sector. I mean, all of these stories, I mean, every time I approach a program, it is much of a learning exercise, as I think it is for the viewer. And I hope that's reflected as a result in what I produce and what I present on the show every week, that me, myself, is equally just as mortified in many cases, as well as astounded by certain stories that we cover.
And tell us about some of the, as you've been able to bring these issues and shine a spotlight on some of these issues, have there been any moments where you've just thought, that made a difference? What are some of those moments that have really made you feel particularly proud of what you've been able to create?
I think in the last 10 years, there's been a number of key moments. I think when we started the show, we both of us thought there was a need for a program like this, but we also thought, hopefully within a decade, if not earlier, that we would sort of get to a point where we would no longer need it. But sadly, that's not the case. If anything, we've seen the rolling back of women's rights. For instance, in 2017, the emergence of the Me Too movement, which was 5 years into the show, both Virginie and I looked at each other and thought, OK, this is the start of something very productive. This is the start of a massive societal change in which we can address openly the issue of violence, directed towards women, gender violence as such, particularly, and the ability for women to speak out and be listened to. But here we are, another 5 years on, and that sadly is not the case. And if anything, we've seen the sort of progress slow back, if anything, gone in reverse. You only have to look at the demise of Roe v. Wade in America, where now millions of women are without access to abortion. You have to look at the situation in Afghanistan or in Iran. I mean, those stories have been stories we've been covering. And I think what we like to do in our show is basically present news with a feminist perspective. The other thing I would also talk about is the problem that many people still have with the word of feminist. For instance, A few weeks back, we went out to do a special edition on the Women's World Cup, of course, which is currently underway. And we spent time with the French national team and I interviewed one of their key players, Kenza Dali. And I asked her about the treatment of women's football versus men's football in France. For instance, this is the country that hosted the Women's World Cup 4 years ago, but men are still paid 20 times more than women. The facilities are a major issue for women's football. And so I said, I asked her opinion, and she started off by saying, I'm not a feminist, but the fact that we do not have the same degree of facilities, the same that we do not have the same degree of medical support, physiotherapists, that I should be treated exactly as my male counterpart. Our bodies are doing exactly the same thing on the field. And I had to stop her after the interview and say to her, but isn't that feminism? You're wanting equality. And that's what feminism is all about. And that's the thing about our show, is reminding people that everybody stands to benefit from equality. It doesn't matter if you're a woman, a man, whoever. Societies that flourish the most economically inevitably have the narrowest gender pay gap. They also have the best form of conditions for working parents. They understand and appreciate parental leave. So, there's an indication of the sort of thing we do with our show. In the last year or so, I think the other two programs, which are very much close to my heart, we went to the US and covered the abortion rights battle in the lead up to the midterms. And we were in Kentucky as well as in Washington interviewing women about what the demise of Roe v. Wade meant. And during the course of the filming, we were in the Kentucky State Parliament. One of the young pro-choice activists who we were talking to, her husband, who was standing next to me, suddenly pulled me aside and said, did you realise that my wife was raped shortly after the Roe v. Wade decision was announced by the Supreme Court? And as a result, there was this grey period in Kentucky where she didn't know whether she'd be able to access an abortion if need be. And as a result, it turned out she was able to seek assistance, Plan B as they call it. But she decided, thanks to her husband telling us about it and also me talking to her, to go on camera and speak to us. This is a married mother of three, a woman who's also studying a master's in social work. And in very moving terms, she explained the stress and the torment that she went through this whole process. And she, as a victim of rape, had not only gone through something horrific, but then had to deal with the possibility of an unwanted pregnancy. So that was an incredibly powerful interview. The other program that we did recently was we went to the UK because the cost of living crisis, along with Brexit, is having an extraordinary impact on women and children in the UK. And we headed to Cambridge, and people said to me, why Cambridge? And I said, because it is Britain's most unequal city, even more so than London or Oxford. So this city, which has been the home to massive scientific research and perhaps has some of the nation's best brains, also happens to have the greatest gap in when it comes to inequality among its residents. And we spent time there in the Abbey Ward, which is in one of the poorest areas of Cambridge, and we went to a food bank and we interviewed people there. And I think the most disconcerting thing was finding, middle-class people lining up for food, predominantly women, social workers and so on. We interviewed teachers, some of whom had talked about their colleagues now, even though they're working, having to seek the help of a food bank. We talked to a nurse who'd been on strike, explaining why, for the first time ever, that her and her colleagues had decided to go out and strike. So, this is what we try and do. We look at a news story as such, but very much take it from a female perspective and hopefully give the viewer an added insight into the impact that these issues are having on all of us.
Wow, it's bringing such critical stories to a broad audience, and now with it potentially being in other languages as well, an even broader reach. What does it mean to you to be recognised as a game changer in these Global Australian Awards?
I'm very, very moved. I think it's a great honour. And I think you can tell by my accent, I'm a very proud Australian. And I like to think that my time, my education, you know, and a large part of my professional career was in Australia. And the values that I learned as a young journalist is something that I still carry with to this day. So for me, it is indeed a very great honour.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I wanted to go back on just one small part of your background, and that was when you were growing up. I saw you went to University of South Australia, maybe where you were growing up, and what did you always aspire to be a journalist, and also did you always aspire to have an international, with your mum being of French heritage, did you always plan on living overseas, and yeah, just what your teenage self would have thought at what you're doing now?
I think my teenage, if I could stand now and tell my 14-year-old self, hey, this is where you're going to be so many years, you know, down the track, I think she would have been blown away. I have to explain, my father was English, my mother was French. So my father, as an architect and academic, actually went abroad. We lived abroad several times, both when I was as a young child and again as a teenager. So, and we have family abroad. So I was always very much connected to the broader world. And I think as a result of that, I understood that there was indeed life beyond Adelaide Hills. And so at the age of 14, I was given a multiple choice questionnaire at school one day where they were starting to get a sense of what did you want to do. And I came home and I asked my dad, and my dad, who was from the north of England, bless him, had a very strong north of England accent, said, oh, you know, well, you're very curious, you're incredibly nosy, you always pinch the newspaper off me, and so I think you should be a journalist. And and I have to point out that one of his closest friends was then an editor-in-chief of The Guardian Weekly, and he was very much always in admiration of what John Perkins had done with his career. And I think, you know, he put one and one together and thought that would be a good suggestion. And I thought about it, and then a few months later, as it turned out, at a youth festival in Adelaide, I don't think it no longer exists, it was then called Come Out Festival, I ended up for a week attending a journalism workshop with a couple of advertiser journalists, and it just opened my mind, and I thought, yes, this is what I want to do, I love it. And so I was very lucky and blessed that very early on in my life I had a sense of what I wanted to do. Obviously I went on to do a journalism degree at McGill campus, you know, it was then the South Australian College of Advanced Education, but during the process became University of South Australia. And it was the right choice. And I remember on the first day at journalism school, our lecturer saying to us, you know, newspaper ink will get into your blood. Well, of course, times have changed and newspapers are no longer just on, you know, printed version, but online as well. But it is very much a profession where you feel like you've signed up to a religious order as such. It's, you know, completely subsumes your life because you work 24/7. You know, you're sometimes in very stressful positions. For instance, I've covered wars when based in Jerusalem. I've been shelled at, I've been bombed, I've covered suicide bombings, you know, all of the above. And, you know, so you sign up for a lifetime of incredible experiences. Perhaps the salary isn't what it should be, and the stress levels can indeed be very high, but it certainly for me has been extremely rewarding. But most importantly, to spend the last decade directing all that experience of mine into this show has perhaps been the ultimate stage of my career, and I just love doing it, and I hope that's reflected in what you see that goes to air.
Absolutely. Well, just one final question from me, and that's around the advice you find yourself giving maybe young journalists or people just entering their career.
Go for it. That's what I'd say. Just be prepared. There are going to be ups and downs. It's like anything these days. But, you know, during those difficult periods where you might be struggling to get a job or working difficult shifts or seeking something better than what you're doing, it will happen. I think perseverance and tenacity are two qualities that you really, really need in this career, along with curiosity and a love of the human race with all of its flaws. And that you, and also I think that, you know, this is me being of the old school, it's your job to give a platform to people whose voices are not necessarily heard to begin with. And again, I hope that's reflected in what we do on the 51%.
Thank you for listening to this episode. For more inspiring stories of global Australian game changers, please go to our website, advance.org.